Hi, this is Bill from Kosiaba Fitness, and today I've got a guest that I'm very excited about interviewing. This gentleman was the first American to hold a black belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. He probably could be considered the originator of kettlebell training in the United States, and he has one of the most interesting lifestyles of anyone I've ever had the pleasure of speaking to. Ladies and gentlemen, Steve Maxwell.
Hello there, Bill. Thanks for having me on the show. It's my pleasure to talk to you today.
Well, Steve, it is, I don't want to use the word an honor, but this is exciting to me. I've been up since 4 o'clock, and I've been like looking at the clock going, when can I call him? When can I call him? I'm ready to do it.
All right. What time is it in Florida right now?
It is 7 a.m.
Okay.
And he asked what time it is in Florida, and that's because Steve is in Oslo, Norway right now. What are you doing in Oslo, Steve?
I'm doing 3 weeks of seminars. Each weekend I'll be teaching a different segment of my system. The first week will be kettlebells, and the next weekend will be bodyweight training. And then the last week, I'm doing something different. It's a new type of teacher training certification. It's basically an overview of my entire system. We're calling it the Pro Cert. It's for trainers and teachers and physical educators that would just like to learn the Steve Maxwell system. And it's basically a compilation of everything I've been doing over the last 43 years as a professional in this field.
Everything? I can't imagine you getting that done in a weekend, because you've done a lot.
Well, it's a compilation. It's just an overview. So yeah, you're right. There's no way that it's the current evolution of this particular system. Let's put it that way. It's always evolving, ever changing. You can never stop learning, and I'm always picking up new ideas and adding and subtracting and experimenting and trying new things. So. You know, next year may be, I wouldn't say totally different, but it would certainly be different than it is this year.
It grows. Well,
it adds and subtracts.
Well, what's the old saying? If something doesn't grow, it eventually dies?
Well, yeah, I mean, for sure.
Well, everything has to grow and everything has to change. You're either getting better or you're getting worse, I think. So, well, you've been doing this for a very, very long time. Let's kind of do the real short form. You've always been into grappling. You were a high school wrestler initially. Was that your beginning?
That's correct. I found that I wasn't particularly good at many sports. I was nearsighted as a child, so this was undiagnosed for many years. So I did develop some of the hand-eye skills that you could that is really important for those type of ball type of sports. And I was kind of an introvert and liked playing by myself. And I was starting to get picked on by some of the neighborhood boys. And my dad saw things going bad. So he basically forced me to go out for wrestling. He just thought that would be good for me. And I found my true love. I was instantly good at it. It was like one of those things where, you know, I had immediate success, and nothing breeds enthusiasm like initial success. And and then it was just a major lifelong love affair with wrestling and grappling. I went on to a Division I wrestling program in school and wrestled Division I NCAA, and was pretty successful. Ended up taking conference championship and went on and coached in the public school system just outside of Philadelphia. But, you know, wrestling is a young man's sport. And, having a career at that time and being a pretty busy guy, it was hard to keep up with wrestling. It's one thing to be in college where you have your daily practices, but it's quite another thing to do it when you're not. And usually collegiate wrestling practices are in the middle of the day. And if you're a working man, it's pretty hard to get there to train with anyone. So I was looking for many years to find that, fill that void that wrestling left. And I tried many different things. Got involved with running and mountain bike racing and triathlons, biathlons, but I wasn't really an endurance athlete, and discovered Gracie Jiu-Jitsu around 1989. Went to the first seminar held in the East Coast, and wow, that was just a real eye-opener for me. It was like the ultimate form of grappling as far as I was concerned. I kind of liken freestyle wrestling as checkers and jiu-jitsu as chess. And that was what I was looking for. And it immediately filled the void. And I don't know whether I had mentioned it, but I opened up the first Brazilian jiu-jitsu school in the Eastern Seaboard. This is before Renzo Gracie or any of those guys.
Well, that leads me to one thing I was going to ask you. Now, I know you had a successful gym in the Philadelphia area for 16 years. Was that gym a jiu-jitsu facility, or was it a fitness strength training type of gym, or was the jiu-jitsu dojo prior to the gym, or?
Well, it was concomitant. For many years, I worked in other people's gyms. I was a fitness director and did sales. After I had quit my teaching job, I did a brief stint in the military, and then went. I realized that I really liked working in the adult fitness industry. I liked working with grown-ups more than kids. Kids can be pretty draining sometimes.
Kids are there because they have to be there. Adults are there because they want to be.
Because they want to be. And so, I mean, don't get me wrong, I really enjoyed working with kids, especially young athletes in both football and wrestling. But I quickly realized, though, that I preferred working with adults. And so I had been involved with the fitness as even a sideline, even when I was teaching school. I worked in gyms part-time, and then, of course, during the summer break, I always had a job in the local gym. So I had been in the fitness industry for a while before I opened up my own place, Matchesize, and that was January 1990. And it was a personal training gym. And right about that same time, I also opened up a jiu-jitsu school in the same building, and that was called Matchesize. And it was pretty much a destination point for many people in the Eastern Seaboard. People would come from all over the place. It was the first of its type and the only one of its type. And so, you know, anyone that was interested in this newfangled Brazilian jiu-jitsu, which was so exciting at the time, they all came through Matchesize at one point. And if you look at a lot of the guys that are running jiu-jitsu club to this day, almost every one of those guys in the Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware area got the start through Steve Maxwell and Matchesize.
Well, so then you're the father of Brazilian jiu-jitsu in the United States, at least.
Well,
the stepfather.
You know, that's not quite, but certainly on the Eastern Seaboard, I gave it a big leg up. In fact, I even had a giant poster of Royce Gracie, one of his UFC posters, and he actually wrote on it, "Thank you for bringing Gracie Jiu-Jitsu to the East Coast." So that was I prized that poster for many years. It hung up on my wall in my gym. There was one thing I would like to correct. I was not the first American to get a black belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, but I was Helson Gracie's first American black belt. But I was certainly within the top 10 guys probably at that time to actually earn a black belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. The Machado brothers had given out a bunch of belts to different guys. But I was the first one, one of the first ones for sure in the United States to get it directly from the Gracie family.
You spent some time with the Gracie family, I believe?
Yeah, quite a bit. Of course, they were in Torrance, California, and I was way over in Philly. So the way I worked, I would go out there for a week, 2 weeks, and train, you know, every day, sometimes twice a day while I was there. And then I would bring all the techniques and so forth back and then work on them with my training partners in Philadelphia. I had a large 1,500-foot square foot matted area upstairs on the second floor of my gym. And, you know, I called all my old wrestling buddies and, you know, there was the Philadelphia Judo Club that I had people to train with, and there was an Aikido Club, literally just two doors down. So I always had plenty of guys to spar with and train and practice my new technique. And having been a Division I wrestler and a coach, I knew how to train for grappling. So I was able to put a pretty decent game together fairly quickly.
I'm curious, going back to your high school wrestling and then your college wrestling, that is way before the era of the world accepting strength training as a positive thing. Did your coaches back then recognize weight training? Did they incorporate it in your training, or was it a lot of drills and running and stretching and cardio type stuff?
My high school wrestling coach was actually very avant-garde. His name was Bill Woods, and one of the finest wrestling coaches. He was right on the cutting edge at that time. And we had extensive weight training circuits that he would run us through. And he even had this the old York isometric power racks that we would do isometric holds and all sorts of weightlifting exercises mixed in with body weight. And it was really, really quite excellent stuff. He had graduated from Westchester State College, the School of Health and Physical Education. And it was because of him that I largely went into that field myself. And I graduated also with a degree in health and physical education from the same college, mostly because I just was so influenced by my early gym teachers and coaches. I knew when I was in eighth grade what I wanted to do with my life, pretty much. I had already made a career choice. And it was mostly because of the positive influence that my coaches had placed on me as a young boy. So, yeah, I started weight training very early. And actually, when I was 10 years old, my father bought me a old York barbell set and would take me down to York, Pennsylvania, which was the then mecca of Olympic weightlifting. Bob Hoffman, Strength and Health magazine, you know, that was like the, he was like the father of weightlifting in the United States. So we would go down every Saturday and watch the Olympic lifters work out. That's back when the U.S. was actually quite good in Olympic weightlifting. And I learned an awful lot about weight training and lifting and got mentored by some of the top guys down there at the York Barbell Club. So that was another profound influence in my early beginnings.
I have to ask you, and probably most of the people listening to this won't recognize any of the names, but for my sake, just because I'm an old hardcore musclehead and a big fan of the old days, who were your mentors at York?
Robert Benarski, who was the last world champion of the United States. He was in a race with Leonard Zabinowski to be the first guy to clean and jerk 500 pounds in competition. I actually watched him do a 505-pound jerk in training, which is pretty amazing. And also there was Joe Duby and Ernie Pickett, and they used to do like little clinics for the kids and give people training tips and so forth. And they were like, you know, the big three for the U.S. back there in those days. And, of course, Bob Hoffman himself was still around. I had the chance to meet him and talk to him. And the great bodybuilder, John Grimmick, who was also an Olympic gold medalist in Olympic weightlifting back in the 1936 Olympics. He was also there. So I had a chance to talk to some of the real old school, old-timer guys and get some good training tips.
That's impressive that you... It's interesting you brought out the point. Grimmick was from the era where people didn't specialize. They could Olympic lift, they could bodybuild. There were actually back in the 40s and 50s several Mr. America winners who were Olympic lifters. Steve Stanko, Grimmick.
Tony Terlazzo.
Yep.
And John Terry, he was the lightweight. He was one of the first Afro-Americans to participate in Olympic weightlifting.
And Tommy Kono, who was an amazing Olympic lifter and won several bodybuilding contests as well.
Correct. Grimmick was so amazing and such an amazing physical specimen that he could do backflips while holding dumbbells. He could easily do handstand press-ups and walk on his hands. He was an amazing dancer. And his posing routine in bodybuilding was just electrifying. He could do muscle isolation movements and literally make the muscles dance. And he was quite a very good dancer, won several dance competitions. So he was quite an all-around Renaissance man when it came to physical training. He could, you know, he could dance, he could do gymnastics, he was amazing at weightlifting as a competition, and of course, you know, one of the finest bodies ever to be built.
Grimmick caused one interesting rule for the AAU. I don't know if you know this, I just know because I've read a lot. They actually changed the rules, I think, in 1942 or 43, that you could only win the Mr. America contest once because he won it 2 years in a row and they just couldn't foresee him ever losing.
I couldn't imagine it myself. I mean, he was just that good. So it's interesting that they put that rule in there. Unlike later times, you know, when, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger was just winning year after year.
Well, that was, you know, all things put on an equal ground, no anabolics involved. I wonder how Grimmick and Arnold would have looked standing side by side.
Well, you know, you just can't discount anabolic steroid drugs. I mean, you know, once that happened, I mean, you know, bodybuilding was changed forever. And in my opinion, it became a shameful sport.
Well, you know, I'd like to think that the guys that ended up on top would have still ended up more or less in the same place with or without, I mean, the genetic gifts. And it did get out of hand, and now it's totally out of hand. The guys you're talking about were athletes. You can't consider today's bodybuilders athletes.
Well, one of the things that I'm very big on is old school training information. Because, you know, with the advent of performance-enhancing drugs, and there's more than just steroids. I mean, there's other things. You know, for example, the movie star's dirty secret is using clenbuterol to get cut up for their movie and television roles. And, you know, when you hear this dietary advice from a current movie star or a fitness star or whatever, you got to take it with a grain of salt. A lot of times they have no clue on what it's like to diet for the average person not using performance-enhancing drugs. You know, these guys are taking growth hormone. There's, you know, other stuff that they're playing around with. So where do you go? Where's a non-drug-using person to go for advice and information? Because you can't trust a lot of the current information out there. You don't know whether it's been tainted. Because, you know, these guys will write a fitness column or a diet column in some magazine, and you know it's all nonsense because they're not really doing that, because you know they're getting their results from taking the drugs, and it has nothing to do with the supplements they're taking or the diet they're on. It has to do with their drug regimen. So where's a young man or young woman to get? Well, you got to go before the 1950s, and you got to look at the old school information that's out there, and there's plenty of websites and old books that you can go and get that type of information.
There's a lot of it out there, and something I found real interesting is all these experts that you're talking about, if you look at their training advice, they're rehashing things from the 40s and 50s, things I read in old muscle magazines in the 60s, and calling it revolutionary and new.
I know, it's really funny. It's so old, it's new. It's like either they forgot or they're just hyping up something that they figured that no one else would know about. But you're right. There's nothing new under the sun. Almost everything I'm seeing out there has already been done at some point somewhere in time. So that doesn't make it bad information. You know, when it comes to training, it's really not that sexy. You know, I mean, truth be known, you don't really need too much. You know, just five or six basic compound movements done a couple times a week, and you know that's it. You're not going to improve on that as far as training regimen go. You know,
it's not that complicated.
It's not complicated at all, and there's nothing to be sold. There's no secrets, and that's the funny thing. You know, everyone's trying to come up with all these different takes and all these different angles and so forth. But I mean, if the average person really knew the truth, there's nothing to be sold and nothing to be bought and really no money to be made.
Spend $30 on an old copy of one of Earl Liedermeyer's books from the 20s or the old York courses from the 30s, and you pretty much got everything you need.
Pretty much everything you need. And if people want to look at and see what, like, you know, non-steroid using men look like, what the potential for a really nice looking physique or body, you know, just go back to the 30s, 40s, and 50s and look at some of the young men and the bodybuilders and so forth of that era. And that was pretty much the genetic potential, you know. And those were the top of the heap genetically in those days. But at least it gives you a basic idea of what a normal human being should look like.
Looking at them is, I think, more inspirational. I think as a young guy when I started training, if I'd looked at pictures of the top guys from the era you're talking about, I would have thought, I can do that someday. But looking at Arnold, that's untouchable. It's unreachable.
It's, yeah, I mean, absolutely so. So now you're blind, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And how long have you been blind, though?
I have a condition called retinitis pigmentosa. I was born legally blind, and I lost the last of my usable vision about 5 or 6 years ago.
I see. So you were able to see some of those old school pictures before you lost your vision.
I had a huge collection of old Hoffman and Weider magazines dating back to the 40s. I think I had the first issue of Joe Weider's magazine from like 1948. So yeah, I was, like I believe I read in one of your other interviews, a huge collector of old strength and training materials.
Okay, that's interesting. I've worked with some blind athletes. One in particular, his name was Russell Redenbaugh, who has won the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu World Championships 3 times now. He's now a black belt, and he lives in Oakland, California. And I never really considered Russell's...
blindness.
Can I use the word handicap, or is that...
You can... Steve, I have a big problem with political correctness. I'm not visually impaired. I'm not visually challenged. I'm blind, okay? So
okay.
Use whatever word you want to use.
Okay. Well, at any rate, that wasn't his main handicap as far as jiu-jitsu was concerned. His main handicap was the fact that he lost half of his hands in the same explosion that took his eyes.
Oh.
He was 17 years old. He was building a rocket ship in the basement of his home in Salt Lake City, Utah. And when there was an accident where there was an explosion, and he was in the hospital for months getting skin grafts for the burns on his hands. They took skin off his stomach and grafted it onto his fingers and hands. And on his right hand, he lost his 3 fingers, the little, the middle, and the ring finger. And so he only had the index and the thumb, and the hand, it was kind of formed into like a hook, almost like fused. And then on the other hand, he lost the thumb and forefinger and only had the 3 fingers. So doing chokes and grabbing the cloth, as you do in jiu-jitsu, for some of your listeners that don't know about jiu-jitsu, it's basically like wrestling with a judo uniform, like wrestling in your pajamas. Except you're allowed to apply painful locks to the joints on a person and choke them. And you can use the uniform to apply a choke. And so not being able to see doesn't really hurt you all that much in both wrestling and jiu-jitsu and judo. In fact, I used to train with a blindfold all the time to develop my sensitivity. And I found that I actually would do better when I couldn't see. I just felt much more sensitive. And we used to train in the pitch black dark also and turn out the lights and cover the windows and the bottoms of the doors with towels and such so that the room would be so pitch black that you couldn't see. And it's a great way to develop your sensitivity and your timing and your feel and your other senses in training. And so Russell did really, really well. He was pretty reluctant in the beginning. And he was worried about his hands primarily, but I'll tell you, because he didn't have the hands, he didn't develop the muscles in the forearm because he couldn't grip like a normal person. So his arms, his forearms are really skinny, and those bones would cut into your carotid sinuses and your neck so bad that it was actually worse in those skinny arms of his. Man, that hurt. So he could choke you pretty quick. He developed all sorts of techniques for using what he did have, and once those arms are wrapped around your neck, man, you pass out pretty fast.
There's always a way.
There's always a way. So, you know, that's what I tell people all the time, man.
Now,
you know, there's no, absolutely no excuses. Here's a guy that was already close to 50 years old when he started, who had virtually no hands and had been blind since 17. And, you know, the guy, he wrestles the age group division, you know, your weight, your belt, your rank, and has done very well. So,
just for clarification, since you were just explaining about jiu-jitsu, how does jiu-jitsu differ from judo?
Judo is, once it became an Olympic sport, first of all, jiu-jitsu was the mother art of judo. But there was many styles of jiu-jitsu. Some styles resembled karate, where you were kicking and punching. Other styles were based on throws and joint locks. And then still other styles specialized in ground fighting. And Jigoro Kano, the founder of judo in Japan, was looking to combine all of the jiu-jitsu styles together in one educational system. He was an educator. And he wanted to develop judo as a physical education tool to promote fitness in the youth in, of the youth in Japan. So they took the best jiu-jitsu techniques at that time and put it together and applied a lot of rules and so forth to make it a little bit more enjoyable to watch for spectators. So they basically took the martial art of jiu-jitsu and made it into the sport of judo. But once it became an Olympic sport, it became more and more stylized, more and more rules, more things you couldn't do. Ground fighting became, they would stand you on your feet within just a few seconds of hitting the ground. So it became so stylized that it lost most of its martial effectiveness. Jiu-jitsu, on the other hand, pretty much remained the same as the old school judo. Like originally judo still had a lot of ground fighting and so forth. And basically it remained in a little time capsule in Brazil where Hélio Gracie developed it into a real serious fighting art. It was basically designed for smaller, weaker people so that they could fight against larger, stronger people. He had discovered a long time ago that once on the floor, the leverage and the size factor was greatly diminished, and the advantage of being bigger and stronger wasn't nearly as much on the ground as when standing up. So the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu continued to specialize in bringing larger, stronger guys to the ground and finishing them there with all sorts of techniques that would damage the joints called joint locks and or strangle holds, and you know. There's many ways that you can do it, either with your arms or using the person's clothing for leverage around the neck. And so jiu-jitsu, once you go to the ground, you continue on the ground. Whereas in judo, it's pretty much basically based on throws. But the throws have become so stylized now that, you know, for self-defense or whatever, it'd be pretty much useless. I mean, there are some older styles of judo, to be fair, that are still have a lot of martial application, but they're few and far between. But jiu-jitsu, on the other hand, it's a pretty formidable self-defense style.
Okay, so no kicks, no punches. It's strictly a grappling sport.
That's the sportive aspect. But then there's the Brazilian jiu-jitsu self-defense, which has slaps and kicks, punches, elbows, headbutts, as well as throws. And of course, the ground technique.
Okay, going back.
So there's
to your...
two branches.
Okay,
because they've retained their martialness and martial effectiveness. In fact, the movement now in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu in the United States, there for a while, even Jiu-Jitsu was becoming so sports oriented that it was almost all just playing on the ground. And a lot of the older self-defense techniques for the street were lost. But now there's a big movement to get the martialness back into Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And the sons of Elio Gracie, the grandsons rather, and even Horian himself, the oldest son of Elio Gracie, they have been doing a lot of seminars teaching all over the world the basic Gracie self-defense.
Okay. I don't know how we got so far into this. This wasn't a direction I planned on going, but it's interesting, so we keep going with it.
Well, since your program is designed primarily for blind people, this is one sport that every blind person, male or female, could easily do if they're looking for something. They're looking for a really, really good martial art, self-defense, great exercise system. There's no one that couldn't do this particular martial art because it's all by feel. You don't have to see anything. And sometimes I think seeing is actually a disadvantage in this particular martial art.
Well, people rely so much on their vision. You know, the mistake people make is, well, you're blind, you must hear so much better. No, I don't hear better. I used to go to a lot of loud rock concerts, but I'm more aware of what I hear. And so I can see what you're saying. By blindfolding yourself, it forces you to become aware of your other senses.
Correct. You're able to concentrate more on the audio part of your senses and not be so sight-dependent.
I knew a
guy. And you just listen a little bit more closely, you know? I know my friend Russell could listen to two conversations at the same time. You could be talking with him and you would be totally cognizant of everything you're saying and be answering you. And in the meantime, he could be listening across the room and then he could tell you what those other people were saying as well. That used to blow my mind. But he had developed his auditory senses to the point where he was able to multitask with his hearing. I thought that was pretty amazing.
I've done that to my wife a few times. We'll be sitting in a restaurant talking, and then I'll start laughing. Well, what? And I'll tell her what I just heard the people at the table on the other side of the room say. And the downside to it is sometimes there's noise pollution. Because you hear every conversation, it's kind of like when you walk into a room and you visually scan the room and you see everything. Sometimes I hear everything and it's hard to focus.
And it's like that movie, The X-Men, right? Who's the guy in the wheelchair, you know? The guy that used to play Captain Picard in Star Trek?
yeah, I can't think of his name.
He's the guy that can hear everything, every voice going on all over the place at the same time.
Whether he wants to or not.
Yeah, whether he wants to or not.
Let's take a jump to kettlebells. How did you first get involved with kettlebells?
Well, after I was always interested in developing myself as a wrestler and a jiu-jitsu fighter. So all my training was always geared to becoming a better athlete. I never lifted weights just for the sake of lifting weights. In other words, I never cared about weightlifting competition. A lot of guys are in there to see how much they can bench or how much they can squat or deadlift or, you know, in the Olympic lifts, how much they can snatch or clean and jerk. You know, so it's always geared towards a performance of some type, either performing a feat, a stunt, or a competitive lift. For me, I could care less. What I wanted was general strength that could be applied to my wrestling, so to make me a better wrestler. I quickly realized that the stronger athlete always has the advantage. All things being equal, the stronger athlete will always win. When I say all things being equal, I'm talking about when skill and technique is even, then your better conditioned, stronger athlete will always win any kind of contest. So I was always looking for a system and systems that would do that for me. And I discovered by accident the Russian kettlebell system. I actually read a, speaking of collecting training information, have you ever run into a magazine called Milo Magazine?
Sure.
Okay, well, I used to get have a subscription to this magazine, and in one of the issues, I read this very humorous article by Pavel Setsoli called Pickles, Vodka, Pickles, and Kettlebells, or something. Basically, a Russian cure for hangover. It was quite funny. And I got really interested in this whole kettlebell thing. And I decided that I was going to try to fashion a pair of these things. I had a pretty good idea what they looked like. And so I had one of my jiu-jitsu students who worked in a metal shop actually fashion me a pair out of stainless steel. And they were pretty serviceable. And I started experimenting with my backyard with these things. And, I very quickly learned what to do and what not to do. And then later, I actually met Pavel he was the first guy to actually, I guess, bring an awareness into modern times about the kettlebells, especially the Russian kettlebell system. And so I met him in Columbus, Ohio, at the Arnold Schwarzenegger Fitness Show. And then we collaborated for a number of years with the RKC and so forth, and I developed my techniques from there. But I started teaching, once the kettlebells were actually manufactured then, when I first started, you couldn't even find a kettlebell anywhere. So once they started manufacturing these things, I just took it around with it. And being well-versed with teaching group exercise, I found that the kettlebell loaned itself really well to group classes, fitness classes. And I always went into kettlebell training with an eye towards fitness as opposed to actually competition. There's your listeners may not know, but there's a type of competition in which you see how many repetitions you can do with the Russian kettlebells. It's a sport called GS Sport or Gearvik Sport, and that's one way to train with kettlebells. But for me, the kettlebells are merely a tool, one of many tools in the toolbox. And I found that certain exercises seemed to really develop me quite well, my endurance capability, my work capacity for wrestling and jiu-jitsu.
Okay, so you were, when you met Pavel, had he started the RKC? Was it just something he had in his head? Was Dragon Door in existence at that time? Or, because I know
Dragon Door had been around for a while. They had promoted various people over the years. And they had not yet put the RKC together. I was one of the founders of that whole system. I was there for the very first one, and I helped create the whole thing, help develop that whole system of training.
I thought it was interesting. I was listening to one of your other interviews last night, trying to look for some facts and figures, and you got on the subject of the getup.
And yes, that was an interesting old school exercise that was credited to the Turkish wrestlers. They would sit down with a heavy barbell or dumbbells, and then they would lie down on the ground and get up. A lot of times they'd do it from a cross-legged position, and there was all of these different variations, of course. But it's quite an interesting exercise. It basically uses every muscle in your body. Holding a weight at arm's length and then lying down and getting back up again, that's
challenging.
Challenging, to say the least. And it can be quite a good developmental exercise for sports, especially combat sports or contact sports.
Well, right now the get-up is my mortal enemy. I'm actually preparing to do the HKC in a month.
Okay. What is the HKC?
When or what?
No, what is it?
The HKC is what Dragon Door calls the entry level to the RKC.
Oh, I see.
It's okay. A one-day certification focusing on swings, get-ups, and goblet squats.
Gotcha. Well, my best advice to you would be to take my seminar instead.
If I didn't have to spend the money to go to Norway or Istanbul or Taiwan, I would.
Or you're just going to have to host me down there in Florida, man.
I would love to take one of your mobility seminars, and we'll have to talk about that. I don't know if we can afford you, but we'll have to talk about that.
I just need a site. I can set up the event.
And the name draws. It's not a problem. I'm just curious, because I know Dragon Door got very militaristic would be a nice word at one point, and very intense. And
well, because kettlebells had their origin a lot of it had to do with the Russian military. It got a little out of hand. They got into this whole pseudo let's play army thing, and you know, I thought it became pretty much disrespectful to the clients that were paying for the certification, and the whole thing was just kind of silly. You know, I just got really dropping people, for safety violations or whatever, or you know, any kind of infraction, people would be made to drop down and do push-ups and things. I just thought it was really stupid, you know, using an exercise as a punishment, you know. And, you know, a lot of these people were professional people. Some of them were pretty high-level trainers in their own right. And it just didn't make sense. And plus, just the sheer volume of work that they made the people do made no sense to me. I mean, why would they try to beat someone up and overtrain them, you know? The idea was to make them feel like they earned their certification, you know? I just thought the whole thing was ridiculous. It's just a big overtraining fest. And for sure, they were courting disaster with overuse and injuries and so forth from the deep level fatigue. And it didn't make sense. It was going against a lot of the principles that, you know, we were trying to teach. It was directly, you know, violating some of those principles that we were trying to teach. So, actually, it's funny because everyone eventually left the RKC. And, you know, the main headliner, of course, was Pablo himself. He was the RKC. And then once he left, it's pretty much kind of a laughingstock now, to tell the God's honest truth.
Well, I've got to ask you, and this is just for my own personal curiosity, because when I first contacted them, it was before Pavel left. And I wasn't refused, but I got some very negative response when I expressed my interest. At the heyday of the RKC, what would have happened if I had said, hey, I'm blind, I've been training people for years, I'm in good shape, I want to do the RKC. Would they have even accepted me to do it?
Yeah, I think so. I certainly could have trained you. The only reason I ever trained Russell with the kettlebells was because he didn't have any hands. You know, he just had those couple fingers. He couldn't grip onto the things. And, I actually tried to make some wrist straps that attached, but, you know, it just didn't work out. I actually made him a special pair of wrist straps that he could do pull-ups and chin-ups and so mm-hmm. forth. Mm-hmm. With his body, because once again, grip was it would hurt his hands to put that little hook that of his forefinger and his thumb over a bar. It would just dig into the wrist in such a way that was really, really uncomfortable for him. But yeah, he was able to do push-ups, and you know, I was able to put pads on the dip rack so he could do dips, and one forearm was a little bit longer than the other because of the way the wrist was fused, so I had to be careful with certain body weight exercises with him. And we did a lot of hammer strength equipment as well, a lot of hammer strength machines.
I was going to say machines would be the solution for him because of the grip issue.
Yeah, so, I mean, he was a very strong man. So, but that other than that, he would have easily been able to learn kettlebells. So, if I was still part of the RKC at that time and you would have said that, for sure I would have, I could have easily taught you how to do kettlebell training. Okay. And I would have used a system of training, a different form of communication. Obviously, I couldn't demonstrate movements and have you try to duplicate it, you know. I would just have to work with you by touch, kinesthetic training.
Exactly. And
that's how I used to teach Russell with the jiu-jitsu. You would actually have him do the move on him 2, 3, 4 times super slow, and then let him try to do the move on you and repeat it super slow, and then very gradually speed it up. So it would have been very easy for me just to kind of mold your body in the proper position and explain very carefully, audibly, what I wanted you to do, and I'm sure you'd have no problem picking it up.
Okay. Snatches might be a little challenging because of the speed factor, but...
Well, the way I would do that, I would actually put you in the end position. I would actually put you where you would finish the snatch. And then you would know what the end point was. Okay, this is where you want to get the kettlebell. This is what it feels like. This is the position, okay? You keep your shoulder packed, your lats engaged. You see where your wrist is. You see, you feel where the kettlebell is in your forearm. That's where you need to get it, from between your legs to this position here. Okay, how are we going to do that? Well, we're going to make use of a movement you already know, which is the swing. And of course, we would have started with the swing. And then, you know, I would just build you slowly to that point, to the point where, okay, I get it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now I've read in a few places you're not a big fan of the snatch.
Well, no, not so much anymore. Not the way it's currently done. If I were to teach you, it would be the half snatch, where rather than swinging it from arm's length overhead back between your legs, I'd have you lower to your shoulder, then swing it back from there. Most of the injuries I've seen over the close to, 17, 18 years I've been teaching kettlebells have always been associated with the snatch.
And I'm guessing with that snatch test of trying to bang out 100 reps in 5 minutes.
It's one of the stupidest things I've ever heard.
Well, that kind of goes to something I've heard you mention in several interviews. How can you possibly maintain good form when your goal is, I've got to get 100 and I'm running out of time?
Well, here's the thing. Okay, now there are people that can maintain good form, you know, and good discipline and so forth. But once you make anything a competition or a timed event, people invariably will throw caution to the wind and they'll just do anything just to make the numbers. And that includes, you know, compromising their own safety. It's just human nature. And maybe at the time it doesn't hurt, or you think you can get away with it, but you can't. And eventually, if maybe not the first time or the second time, sooner or later you're going to create a real serious injury in there. So this type of timed repetitions don't make sense to me whatsoever. Now, I'm not against doing lengthy sets. I'm not against pushing oneself. But one has to be smart enough to know when the form is beginning to break down, and then you got to just stop yourself. And just pushing beyond that into poor form, it's just, you know, it's just crazy. It's insane.
And this
And once you get hurt, man, it takes so long to overcome injury, especially as you get older. I don't know, how old are you now, Bill?
55.
Well, listen, you're too old to be screwing around hurting yourself. And once you mess up those shoulders, you're pretty much going to be permanently impaired. To tell the God's honest truth, I'd tell you to call up the Dragon Door and get your goddamn money back.
Hi, Teresa.
That's my girlfriend laughing in the background.
Yes, I heard. Well, that's why I'm doing the other seminar, which is only the get up, the swing, and the goblet squat. I looked at the idea of doing the snatch test, and I went, there's just no way in hell my shoulders can do that.
Exactly. And it doesn't make sense. And why would you want to do it? And what benefit? You have to look at the risk to benefit. You know, just because I can, should I? And what are the risks compared to the drawbacks? You know, sometimes the drawbacks are pretty heavy duty. You pay a big price.
Yeah. This is.
And you have to ask yourself those things, you know? I mean, this is for anyone listening out there. The risk to benefit ratio, you know, in my opinion, a person that is getting hurt in training has no clue what they're doing. Now, playing sports, it's different. I expect to get hurt in jiu-jitsu. You can't do a combat sport or a contact sport without suffering an injury. You can't even do something I know there's many unsighted people that do triathlons, you know, they ride those tandem bikes with a partner.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I used to run with Russell, having him hold my elbow. And we used to run, and I got really good at verbal cues, man. God, I was good. I'd tell him when curbs are coming up, when branches and trees, when there would be signs. It made me incredibly alert, and I got so good at describing stuff. We used to go to the movies together, and I'd whisper in his ear the different things that were going on in the scene and so forth.
Really so, sucks when you forget to mention those branches.
Yeah, it really does. But I got so good at, you know, not running him into stuff when we would run, man. And we were running in Center City, Philadelphia, the streets, man. And we ran never with incident at all.
So like, you were not only dodging obstacles, you were dodging people.
People, obstacles. Of course, we'd usually do it at like 5 a.m. in the morning, so it kind of cut down on some of the people. But, you know, well, I got, so But the key is, you cannot do sports without expecting some type of injury or whatever. But when it comes to actual physical training, when you're fitness training, training for health, longevity, you know, to look good naked, whatever, whatever your goal is, you should not be injuring yourself. You should not be hurting yourself. And if you are, you're doing something wrong. Your basic overall exercise philosophy is wrong, and you need to change that. And doing things like RKC snatch test, what does that have to do with anything? Really, truly. It means that you're good at doing snatches, you know? It means nothing at all.
Okay, so, this is a great segue to going to what you think about CrossFit.
Well, once again, it's a form of insanity, CrossFit. I mean, if you think about it, like, how can you compete in exercise? People that compete in exercise need to find a real sport, you know? Competing in push-ups and kipping pull-ups and, you know, throwing weight around and flipping tires. I mean, that's all well and good. I suppose if that's what floats your boat, you know, but for the most part, it's certainly not the best way to train. And it doesn't, you know, they talk about preparing you for anything. It prepares you for nothing. You're not good at anything at all. And it really galls me when I see that guy, you know, they tout him as the world's fittest man. It's not true. He's not the world's fittest man. There's no way that you can be the world's fittest man. There's no such thing as the world's fittest man. You're fit at what you do and only at what you do. And, you know, you're either sort of kind of good at a bunch of stuff or you're really, really good at one thing. And there's nothing in between.
Well, you can't be good at a lot of things, really good at a lot of things. Nah, nobody
you
is.
You cannot. You cannot. You got to pick and choose. Now, I'm not against cross-training. You know, I like to do some running. I love Spider-Man crawls. I've pretty much returned to my roots, and I'm back to, like, high-intensity training, pretty much single-set-to-failure type stuff. I'm finding that at 62, it's really a good way for me to train. Certainly makes my joints feel good. And I'm noticing some good hypertrophy, even at my age, with the high-intensity training model. You know, the Mike Mentzer, Arthur Jonesian philosophy.
Sure.
A lot of people are finding that as they get older, that's an excellent training philosophy to follow, and it's certainly easier on your joints. It makes you feel pretty good because form is everything. But CrossFit, pretty crazy stuff, man. You don't see too many people over 40 doing it. You might see a few here and there, but they don't usually last long.
I had recently had to talk the wife of a friend of mine who lives up in New England out of joining CrossFit. She was wanting to get in shape, and one of her coworkers had done it and gotten in amazing shape. I said, yeah, but it's
well,
just...
Well, see, I call that being ruined by your success.
Mm-hmm.
Just because you're successful doing something doesn't mean it was the best way to do it. And so often people will have immediate success or at least initial success doing a particular brand of training. But then the shame of that is they never explore anything else. They get stuck in one mode and only one mode, and they don't try some other things. So I call that being ruined by your success because, you know, generally speaking, people should be open-minded and they should, you know, try logically sounding things. I mean, obviously, if something sounds illogical, you know, you wouldn't want to try it. I don't have to try certain things to know it would be really bad for me.
I'm going to do a real big jump here, and let's talk about nutrition a little bit.